Welcome to episode 136 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and joining me today is Dennis Palumbo, whose Head Wounds, the fifth novel in his mystery series about Pittsburgh-based psychologist Daniel Rinaldi, has just been published. Years after her death, Dr. Danny Rinaldi is still combing the past for answers to questions about his wife's murder. Just as he's reviewing the case once again, along comes a homicidal maniac threatening to kill both strangers, patients, and Danny's loved ones alike. In a race against the clock to prevent more deaths, Danny learns a thing or two about his wife and about himself. Here's Dennis Palumbo. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I'm delighted that we've got Dennis Palumbo, who is a licensed therapist and a mystery writer, to talk about his fifth Dr. Daniel Rinaldi novel, Head Wounds. Welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. It's nice to be here.
So, congratulations on Head Wounds. As I mentioned, it's your fifth Dr. Daniel Rinaldi novel, and I guess the question has to be asked. Danny Rinaldi is a psychologist. Dennis Palumbo is a psychologist. Are the two of you related?
Well, let me see. My lead character, like myself, Dr. Rinaldi, is born and raised in Pittsburgh, graduated from Pitt, is Italian-American, has a blue-collar background, and wears glasses and a beard. Other than that, I can't think of any connection he and I have together. Seriously, he is a sort of idealized version of me. He's smarter, he's more resourceful, and he was a former amateur boxer, which is something that I would never, ever do. But I do enjoy having the opportunity through my novels, since they are in first person, to give the reader an idea of what goes on in a therapist's head during treatment sessions, and also to talk some about trauma, which I think is infiltrating our country right now. I think, as leading trauma expert Robert Stollero once said, we're in the age of trauma. And I think my character's somewhat unique in that he's a psychologist, but he's also a trauma expert. He consults with the Pittsburgh police, and his job is to treat the victims of violent crime, people who may have survived a kidnapping or a sexual assault or a burglary, but who still live with the after effects of that traumatic event, symptoms we tend to associate with post-traumatic stress disorder. And, of course, since this is a mystery thriller and my hero's an amateur sleuth, he ends up getting a lot more involved in the stories than you might initially suppose.
Well, your career trajectory is interesting. You were a very successful screenwriter before you became a licensed psychotherapist. So here's my question as a fellow writer. How did writing, and specifically writing in Hollywood, help you make the transition to helping people deal with their mental health? And how does working with individuals on their neuroses, many of them writers, and associated issues, help you with your writing?
Well, those are really big, wide-ranging questions. I'll do the best I can to answer them. I think the idea that the genesis of my transformation from a screenwriter to a therapist is not that complicated. I went into therapy myself about 13 or 14 years into my TV and screenwriting career, and I fell in love with the process. So I started taking a lot of classes in psychology. I began volunteering at psychiatric facilities and low-fee clinics, and I kept telling myself, well, even if I don't actually become a therapist, it can't hurt a writer to get an MA in psychology. And before you know it, I realized that I actually liked working with patients, and I wanted to change my life. So after about 6 years and 3,000 clinical hours as an intern, I sat for the exam and got licensed as a psychotherapist and retired from show business. After 17 years, I stopped writing and directing TV and screenplays. And in the last 28 years, I've been in private practice treating primarily creative people. And first of all, they're a wonderful pool of patients to work with. They're motivated, they're articulate, very, very smart. And I have a lot of familiarity with the issues that they bring to treatment. I mean, if someone's anxious about pitching an idea to somebody, well, I've pitched 1,000 times, so I know what they're going through. And if people come in concerned about writer's block or procrastination or fear of failure or anxiety and depression, I've been there in all those categories. And I think that makes me uniquely qualified as a therapist to deal with these issues. On the other hand, there's a sort of second parallel track. My first job in Hollywood was as a writer on the show Welcome Back, Kotter, which your viewers or listeners are probably way too young to remember. But the same week I got that job, my first mystery short story was bought by Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. I've always been a huge mystery fan. And one of my dreams, even after I left show business and began working as a therapist, one of my dreams was to create a series character. And the other thing I wanted to do was write about Pittsburgh, my hometown, which has changed so radically since I was there. You know, I grew up in the Pittsburgh with steel mills, a very blue-collar town, very smoky skies, and that Pittsburgh is gone. I put myself through college by working at J&L Steel Mill, and those mills are gone, and Pittsburgh has become quite the white-collar town. I call it a shot-in-a-beer town colliding with the information age. Now Pittsburgh's known for state-of-the-art technology and for its medical facilities. And so my lead character, like me, bridges both worlds. The blue-collar, cobblestone street worlds of older Pittsburgh, and the more modern world. Like me, he was the first in his family to go to college, to wear a jacket and tie, and to be a white-collar professional. These issues resonate with me very strongly. And then you add on to that as many twists and turns and as much suspense as I can pile into a book, and that's how the Daniel Rinaldi series began.
I promise we'll get to head wounds in the next question, but I want to ask you about Hollywood on the Couch, which is a column that you write for psychologytoday.com. And specifically, right. I wanted to ask about the entry about the writer who asked you if all creative people are crazy, and he based it on an NPR story he heard. My whole working life, people have said to me, why do you write? When are you going to get a real job? How can you live with deadlines? And my response is always, because it's what I seem to do best, and how can you live without deadlines? You know, to me, it's great when something is over. I'm not bipolar. I think I write and then stop for the day and live like anyone else who has a job. So are writers all varying degrees of crazy? I mean, say mildly neurotic to total batshit? I mean, it's a rhetorical question. But I think I'd like to hear that addressed by someone who actually knows about it. It's like writers are not crazy, are they?
No, of course not. In fact, the conventional wisdom that writers have a particular kind of neurotic quality to them or symptomatology is just ridiculous. First of all, we have to be very, very careful that, you know, mental health diagnoses are kind of flung around pretty liberally nowadays. But if you look at someone like Van Gogh, he had all the traits and symptoms that we would associate with bipolar disorder. But that disorder did not cause his genius. There are many, many, many people with diagnosis of bipolar who are not geniuses. The impulse to create just comes from a need to communicate what's in your mind and heart. You see, in my experience, writers, the raw materials that a writer or any creative person, an actor, whatever, the raw materials are inside of them. And so writers tend to write about their struggles with depression or anxiety. Believe me, I have had patients who are lawyers, doctors, engineers. They're as neurotic as anyone else, but they don't think about it. They often don't feel inclined to discuss it with anyone, and they certainly don't write about it. So if you think about it, if a bricklayer is depressed, he can still put bricks up every day and go home and have three beers, and he's fine. A writer is depressed. Well, he or she has to go deep inside themselves to be a writer. They have to mine their feelings. And so that depression they may be feeling or anxiety they may be feeling, that affects what they're doing. And so if you think that, wow, you know, let's look at it this way. What's the number one indicator of depression? It's suicide. Well, more dentists commit suicide than writers. More psychiatrists commit suicide than writers. And so the idea that somehow if you're a writer, you're crazy. The only thing crazy about it is trying to make a living at it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if you're like a narcissistic, self-aggrandizing attorney, you can make a lot of money. If you're a narcissistic, self-aggrandizing novelist, you may live moment to moment in dire poverty. The only difference is our culture supports one job and doesn't support the other.
Okay, well, I feel like I've gotten a small dose and I feel a little bit better. And to your formula for writing, I would add curiosity. I mean, I think that a healthy curiosity is really, you know, part of being a writer.
Oh, I would agree. I think whether you're a nonfiction writer or a fiction writer, curiosity about the world is absolutely crucial to your work, which is why certain scientists, certain oceanographers, certain lawyers, certain doctors who make discoveries or who explore their career very, very deeply do so out of that kind of curiosity wedded with their creative approach. I don't think either creativity nor curiosity is limited to people who do creative efforts for their career.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. If you go to see an eye doctor with a condition that you don't understand and he doesn't understand, you better hope he or she is curious about figuring it out what it is.
Yes, exactly. So let's talk about Head Wounds, your new book.
Yep.
And in Head Wounds, your bad guy is completely off the charts. And I would put his sinisterness and overall evil intent into Hannibal Lecter territory. Although, as far as I know, Sebastian Maddox, which is his name, is not a cannibal.
No, he is. I'm glad to hear you say that because the reviews have been, I'm very gratified by the reviews the books have gotten, but particularly the blurbs from other writers I respect, like Thomas Perry and Sean Chertover. The thing, and Tim Hallin, and what they all talk about is how harrowing and vivid and scary my villain is. And what's unusual for me is that in the previous four books, they are mystery thrillers, and there's a lot of suspense and twists and turns, but the villain remains, a mystery. We have to solve who the bad guy is. What I did with Head Wounds that I hadn't done before is I let the reader know pretty early on who the bad guy is, so that it becomes more of a cat-and-mouse game between Daniel Rinaldi and Sebastian Maddox. And I felt to fuel a cat-and-mouse game like that, it had to be something intensely personal. And so that's why the stakes are very high. That's why the threat to Daniel's friends and patients is very, very vivid and palpable. And I wanted to create a villain that would scare me. And he scares me. And one of the proudest moments of my life is when Edgar Award-winning author Thomas Perry was given and doing an interview a couple months ago about his favorite new reads, and he included Head Wounds and says, not a day goes by that I'm not haunted by the villain in Dennis's book. Well, to me, that's high praise from the guy who won the Edgar for The Butcher's Boy. So I'm very happy to hear that you found him scary, because most of my readers do.
Well, you know, yes, he's very scary. And actually, you and I think, live in the same neighborhood, so I'm hoping he's not based on somebody you know, in which case I'll probably have to get a better security system. But where did he come from? I mean, you know, as your imagination built him, where did he come from?
Well, frankly, he came from an article I read on erotomania, which is a big aspect of the book. For your listeners, erotomania is a psychological condition, quasi-delusional, in which a person imagines that someone else is their soulmate, their, you know, lover for all eternity. Even if the other person doesn't know you or does know you but just thinks you're being crazy and wants nothing to do with you, erotomania is a very powerful delusional condition. And so if a person, for example, let's say that you and I work together in an office and I develop an erotomania connection to you, I might then decide that every time you took off your glasses, it was a secret signal to me that you loved me. Or that every time you wore green, that was a private message between the two of us. And what happens, what makes it so terrifying, is the person struggling with this condition starts stalking the object of his love, incredibly jealous if he or she is, you know, dating someone else, and often ends up where the object of the love ends up having to get a restraining order. And so I realized I was trying to give my readers who had asked about it over the past four books, could you give us the details of what happened to my hero's wife? In the first book in the series, I explained that my hero, Daniel Rinaldi, is a widower, and that he and his wife were mugged, and during the mugging, she was killed. And people have asked me, well, come on, there's got to be more to it than that. So when I read about erotomania, I said to myself, what if my villain had an erotomania condition, and that it was focused on and constellated on Daniel Rinaldi's wife before Daniel met her? So that when Daniel and Barbara, his wife, get married, Sebastian Maddox sees this as the ultimate betrayal by his soulmate. And so his goal is to kill her and kill Daniel. He kills her, he doesn't kill Daniel. He goes to prison on an unrelated drug charge. When he comes out 10 years later, now he's going to destroy Daniel's life because he finds out Daniel survived. He had thought he'd killed him. Not only had he survived, but he'd been involved in these high-profile police cases and was like a talking head on CNN. The way I created Daniel Rinaldi, he's become kind of a national figure that the news media go to all the time, like those special guests they have on the talk shows and CNN. And so now Sebastian Maddox is furious because Daniel Rinaldi's living a good life now. And so he decides he's going to punish him by taking away all the good things in Daniel's life the way Sebastian believes Daniel took Barbara away from him.
Well, you know, I like to look at and when I read a novel, a crime fiction novel, you know, to me it's interesting if there's something sort of beyond the story. And I thought Head Wounds was a crime fiction novel about the bad places obsession can lead. And Danny is obsessed as well. He's obsessed with finding out what was behind his wife's murder. And Sebastian is, well, you know, just obsessed. So is that fair, or am I reading too much into it?
Not at all. All the things you're mentioning, first of all, I mean, I even opened the quote with a book about, a quote about the obsession. The thing is, I see Daniel and Sebastian as two sides of the same coin. Daniel has been obsessed about his wife's death. He went through years of therapy due to his survivor guilt. he has all the symptoms of someone suffering from trauma that the patients he sees do. In fact, that's the source of his mission because of what had happened to him. And no, I think you're not alone. A number of people have noted the symmetry of Daniel's journey through his own obsession and Sebastian Maddox's journey through his. They're doppelgangers of each other. And I think that's one of the most powerful themes in the book, of what obsession does to us, how it can turn love into hate, how it can turn guilt into obsession. It's very powerful material, and it's disguised as a thriller.
And it's the disguise is very, very convincing because it is a very scary book.
Well, I wanted it to be scary because oftentimes, you know, when you do a mystery series, the reader goes, well, yeah, it's book number 5. He survived the first 4 books. He's going to survive this one. The best thing that I've heard so far is people are actually worried whether Daniel is going to survive this or not, whether he was actually going to get outwitted and killed. And that couldn't make me happier. I really wanted the reader to be really worried about Daniel and his friends. You know, and what often happens in crime thrillers is the people who are victimized by the bad guy, they're just chess pieces in the story. We don't get to know them or care about them. And so one of the things I did was make sure that the people that Sebastian Maddox was beginning to track down and try to do damage to are characters who have been in the Daniel Rinaldi books from the very beginning. So any reader who knows the books goes, oh, my God, do you think, would he actually kill Noah? Would he actually kill Eleanor? You know, I want them to be really worried. And, you know, like I said, in most books, whether it's the hero or the hero's friends, if they're ever threatened by anything, you know they're going to be fine. In this book, you don't know that.
Well, we won't introduce any spoilers, but you're absolutely right. We can safely say that not everyone makes it out of Head Wounds alive.
Right.
And
I remember when I first handed the book in, my editor at Poison Pen said, you know, it's pretty painful, this death. And I said, yeah, I want it to be. Because this is one of those people we've known for a while. So, but I wanted it to be so harrowing that Daniel Rinaldi will never be the same again. And that's the feeling I wanted the reader to have at the end of the book. That though he survived this and found out what happened to his wife and why, he'll never be the same. He's just been re-traumatized once again.
So that's actually a great segue to my last question. At the end of Head Wounds, you know, as you mentioned, some of the things are resolved in Danny's life and others aren't. He's met and become involved with another woman. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what you have planned next for Dr. Rinaldi.
Well, here's the funny thing. Daniel Rinaldi tells me what we have planned next. I have no idea. I never know what I'm doing when I start a book. I never know what's going to happen to Danny and what's going to happen to the other people. And I've been thinking about where, you know, book 6 might go. I have lots of different ideas, but I know it sounds kind of crazy, but Daniel hasn't kind of told me yet. I have to picture him in his house on Mount Washington having a Jack Daniels and looking out over his deck over the Three Rivers, the point in Pittsburgh where the Allegheny and the Monongahela form the mighty Ohio River. And while he's looking down there, hopefully a story will occur to me. No, I don't know what's going to happen with him and the female FBI agent he becomes involved with. I also don't know what's going to happen to his old girlfriend with whom he's taking a break for 6 months. So I actually don't know whether he's going to be in a love triangle or both women are going to tell him to jump off the deck. I don't know. We'll find out.
And it gives us something to look forward to because he's a very interesting guy and he's working in an interesting place.
I think so. I think Pittsburgh is a character in itself in the book. I like to think so anyway. And I also think that Daniel is a pretty good representation of a male therapist, complicated, difficult, and as I've written him, a little snarky, a little prone to anger, and a little full of himself, with a little bit of a hero complex. And most of that is derived from his guilt. There's a moment early in Head Wounds where he's describing, you know, his recovery from the mugging and the fact that his wife died and he didn't. And he said, for some inexplicable reason, I was lucky. And I've been trying to earn that luck ever since.
Well, as far as a one-word description, I thought irascible sort of fit Dr. Rinaldi.
A good word. Irascible is exactly right. It's a tad kinder than I see him, but I think irascible is a very good word. The police just look at him as a pain in the ass, a know-it-all. One of the things that I like doing also is he's a civilian, and there are civilian consultants to the police, but very few rank and file have much to do with the consultants. They don't like them, and they particularly don't like them if they're psychologists. And so I thought it would create a lot of character tension between him and the police, and I have a lot of fun with those scenes.
They are fun to read, and they are sort of fun to pretend you're a fly on the wall, because I would assume that they're fairly accurate for the reasons that you described. The police don't like
Schmitz. Very accurate. I know an LAPD detective. I've known him for years, and I talked to him about this stuff, and he said, oh, my God, we hate him. In fact, when an officer is involved in a shooting, as you know, they usually have to go in for mandated therapy. And police psychologists here in Los Angeles, they're in a nondescript building in Chinatown so that other cops don't have to see you go into an office that says shrink, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so what the LAPD did is say, oh, where's Officer Bob? They go, well, he's in Chinatown. And what that means is he's seeing a therapist. God knows we all need support. These are tough times. I said the age of trauma, whether it's crime or tsunamis or terrorisms or, you know, it's a pretty tough time. And with the media slamming us with data 24/7, the world can feel unmanageable.
And that's why we have books like yours, places where we can...
Oh, okay.
Where we can suspend, you know, it's great. I mean, I think it seems counterintuitive, but I think that suspending disbelief and spending time with an obviously deranged man like Sebastian Maddox is cathartic and a wonderful escape from the real world.
Well, that's what I hope it is. I hope it reflects some of the real world, but gives us a sense of dramatic narrative and completion that the real world, unfortunately, doesn't always do.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Palumbo, for your time, and Dennis, and for talking about your character and your book and your work and where all of those roads intersect. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. If your listeners are interested in finding out more about me, I suggest they go to my website, which is cleverly named DennisPalumbo.com, and they can read about my books. They can read about, you know, some of the articles that I've posted in Psychology Today, some short stories. There's a little bit of something for everybody.
I will post the link on the site. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Nancy.
You're welcome.